The Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're diving into, well, one of the most complex and foundational collections of writings out there, the New Testament.
Mm-hmm. It really is.
And if you've ever picked it up and felt, you know, maybe a bit overwhelmed, or perhaps felt pushed towards one single kind of simplistic interpretation.
Which happens a lot.
Exactly. Then this deep dive is for you. We want it to be your intellectually honest roadmap. We're using Luke Timothy Johnson's fantastic book, The New Testament, a very short introduction as our guide.
And a great choice. Mm-hmm. Johnson really insists we need to shift how we even approach these 27 writings. So our mission today really is to move beyond seeing the New Testament as just one single uniform book.
Oh, okay.
We need to see it for what it actually is.
Okay.
A diverse library of writings. And maybe more importantly, the literary residue, the leftovers, almost of the early Christian community's dynamic lived experience.
That phrase, literary residue, is powerful. And the relevance today, I think, is huge. Johnson gives you a kind of toolkit for engaging with this stuff.
Yeah.
Whether you come at it from faith or history or just, you know, plain curiosity, it's a critically informed, honest way in. Mm-hmm. He helps us tackle this ancient collection without feeling like we have to check our brains at the door, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And to really feel the weight of his argument, you need to know a bit about him.
Mm.
Luke Timothy Johnson. He's a big deal in the field.
Okay, tell us about him.
He's the Robert W. Woodruff Professor Emeritus at Emory University. A really highly respected New Testament scholar. Commands respect across the board, academically speaking.
But there's more to it, isn't there? His background is unusual.
That's what makes him so interesting. He has this rare dual perspective.
Mm-hmm.
On one hand, rigorous academic chops, advanced degrees in classical literature, serious scholarship.
Right.
But he combines that with this deep insider's appreciation. He was actually a Benedictine monk and a priest for a time.
Wow. Okay.
So he lived with these texts as scripture, you know, felt their power from the inside before he started dissecting them like an academic historian might.
That combination must give him a pretty unique viewpoint.
It really does. And it lets him stake out his own distinctive position. He's quite critical of what he calls these reductionist historical critical quests.
Like what, for example?
Well, think about the obsessive search for the so-called historical Jesus, trying to prove exactly who Jesus was using only sources outside the Gospels. Johnson argues those quests fundamentally miss the point of the texts themselves.
So if the point isn't just pure objective history, what is it then, according to Johnson?
He argues they miss the theological purpose. It's like, imagine trying to understand a beautiful stained glass window mm-hmm. by just analyzing the chemical makeup of the glass and the lead strips.
You'd miss the whole picture, the light, the story.
Exactly. You miss what it's for. Johnson sees these texts are trying to do something specific. Articulate, shape, and sustain a really powerful religious experience centered on Jesus.
Okay, that makes sense. Let's dig into his central argument then. He calls it the third way, right?
That's it. The main idea is this. The New Testament's primary purpose wasn't to document history like a modern journalist would, not facts and figures in that sense.
Right.
It was written by people utterly convinced that God had done something decisive in Jesus.
Yeah.
And they were grappling with what that meant. They were trying to explain that conviction.
So this third way is his answer to two common pitfalls.
Precisely. He sees two extremes that just don't work. On one side, you've got naive literalism, reading everything as flat historical fact, ignoring context, genre, everything.
Like thinking Revelation is just a literal timeline of the future.
Exactly, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And on the other side, you have this overly skeptical historical reductionism. That approach strips the texts of all their power, their meaning, leaving them sort of dry and irrelevant. Just historical footnotes.
So Johnson's path is in the middle.
It's a middle path, but it's not just a compromise. It's a critically informed reading, one that takes history and literature seriously, but it's also imaginatively engaged. It appreciates these texts as powerful works of religious literature designed to actually transform the reader's life.
And how does the book guide us through that?
He breaks it down nicely. First, he grounds us in the essential historical and cultural context you have to understand the world they came from.
Second Temple Judaism, the Greco-Roman world.
Right. Then second, he helps us recognize the different kinds of writing in there, the literary forms, gospel, epistle, apocalypse. They aren't all the same.
Makes sense.
And third, he tackles that big critical question. How and why did these specific 27 writings, and not others, become the official canon, the recognized collection?
It really is about realizing you're holding a whole library, not just a single book.
That's the key shift.
Okay, let's start exploring that library. Johnson really emphasizes understanding the world of the New Testament. He insists, doesn't he, that we have to grasp that early Christianity started as a Jewish movement.
Absolutely essential. You just cannot understand the New Testament without understanding the diversity and tensions within Second Temple Judaism.
We tend to think of ancient Judaism as monolithic, but it wasn't, was it?
Not at all. Johnson walks us through the key groups. Pharisees, Sadducees, Essenes, others too.
Mm.
They had really different takes on things like messianic expectation, how to be pure, how much to cooperate with the Roman occupiers.
So it was a pretty charged atmosphere.
Incredibly charged.
Mm-hmm.
Politically, religiously.
Yeah.
It was fertile ground, you could say, for a new movement centered on someone like Jesus to emerge and gain traction.
And ironically, the Roman Empire itself kind of set the stage for this Jewish sect to spread far beyond Judea.
It's a fascinating paradox, isn't it? The empire, built for conquest and control, inadvertently provided the perfect infrastructure.
How so?
Well, first you had Koine Greek, a common language across the vast eastern Mediterranean. It was the lingua franca, kind of like the internet of its day, allowing ideas to travel easily. And then the Roman roads, built for legions and tax collectors, sure, but they became the highways for early Christian missionaries like Paul.
So this mix of Jewish ferment, Greek language, and Roman roads, it all came together.
It created this unique, volatile set of conditions.
Yeah.
Necessary for the rapid expansion that happened.
Right. Let's move from the world around the text to the core of the collection for many people, the Gospels. Johnson has a very specific take here.
He does. He's really emphatic.
Hmm.
The Gospels are theological portraits, or maybe interpreted narratives. What they are not is modern objective biographies trying to give you a minute-by-minute account of Jesus's life.
And that's a fundamental shift for a lot of readers, I think. We expect history in that modern sense.
We do. And so the differences between Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, people often see those as a problem, like proof of unreliability.
But Johnson flips that.
He completely flips it.
Yeah.
He argues the differences are a sign of theological richness, not historical failure. Think of it like maybe four brilliant artists painting portrait of the same person.
Mm-hmm.
Each artist has their own style, their own emphasis, the aspects they want to bring out, the select details, arrange them. The result isn't four identical photographs, but four distinct, insightful portraits. Each reveals something true.
So Mark, for instance, Johnson points out it's likely the earliest. What's its portrait like?
Mark is very urgent, yep. Fast-paced. It presents Jesus as this powerful but often misunderstood Messiah. His identity is kind of a secret, the messianic secret, until the very end at the crucifixion. There's a focus on suffering.
And then you jump to John's gospel, worlds apart almost.
Completely different feel. John is the most theologically distinct. It doesn't even start with Jesus' birth. It starts with this profound cosmic prologue. Jesus as the divine logos, the word of God, present from creation.
Wow.
Highly symbolic, very reflective. It's all about revealing Jesus's divine identity from the get-go. So yeah, different portraits, different theological palettes, as Johnson puts it.
Okay, so the Gospels lay a foundation, but the earliest writings we actually have are Paul's letters, right?
That's right. And Johnson stresses they are contingent documents. This is a huge concept for understanding them properly.
Contingent. What exactly does that mean in this context?
It means they weren't written as timeless theological essays for the ages. They were written in response to specific real-life immediate problems happening in the communities Paul had founded or was connected with.
So they're like urgent emails or troubleshooting guides.
That's a great analogy. Think of them as crisis management documents in many cases. Paul wasn't just sitting back stroking his beard and thinking deep thoughts in the abstract.
He was writing to the church in Corinth because they were a mess, right? Divisions, lawsuits, people behaving badly.
Exactly. Factionalism, people arguing about spiritual gifts, someone sleeping with his stepmother. I mean, real messy human situations.
Mm-hmm.
Or writing to the Galatians about whether Gentile converts needed to follow Jewish law.
So his big theological ideas like justification by faith, life in the spirit, they came out of trying to fix these specific problems.
That's Johnson's point. The theology emerged directly from these pastoral practical struggles. It shows us that theology in the New Testament isn't abstract speculation. It's practical, rooted in community life, which ties back to that idea of the texts being the literary residue of a living movement.
The surviving artifacts of something messy and vibrant.
Precisely. It wasn't neat and tidy.
And that messy vibrancy continued beyond Paul, too. Johnson makes a point of highlighting the diversity within the canon itself.
Yeah, it wasn't all just Paul. If you only read Paul, especially a simplistic reading focusing only on faith alone, you might miss other crucial perspectives. The canon itself provides a kind of internal balance.
Like the letter of James.
James is the perfect example. It has this fierce emphasis on practical action, on works. You know, the famous line, faith without works is dead. It pushes back against any faith that doesn't result in ethical living and social justice.
So Paul and James aren't necessarily contradicting each other, but offering different facets.
Johnson would say they represent the healthy tension within the early movement. The strength of the New Testament library lies partly in holding these diverse, sometimes seemingly conflicting voices together. It teaches us that unity doesn't have to mean rigid uniformity.
That's a powerful idea for today, too. Okay, we have to touch on the final book, Revelation. It causes so much confusion and, frankly, weird interpretations.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Johnson is very clear and very firm on this. He argues passionately against reading Revelation as some kind of predictive code or detailed blueprint for future historical events.
He has a specific quote on this, doesn't he?
He does. He says, and this is worth hearing, "To read the book of Revelation as predictive code for future events is to fundamentally misinterpret its genre."
Genre. Okay, so what is its genre then?
It's a classic example of apocalyptic literature that was a specific type of writing popular in Judaism around that time.
And what does apocalyptic mean here? Not just end of the world.
Not primarily. It means unveiling or revealing. Apocalyptic literature uses highly symbolic language. Think dragons, beasts, cosmic battles, angels, to pull back the curtain on reality.
To reveal what?
To reveal God's ultimate control and justice, operating behind the scenes of present chaos and oppression. Revelation was written, Johnson argues, as a powerful work of theological resistance.
Resistance against what?
Against the overwhelming power and persecution of the Roman Empire. It's addressing Christians who are suffering, maybe facing martyrdom. It uses this wild imagery to assure them that, despite appearances, despite the beast of Rome, God is ultimately sovereign and will bring justice.
So it's not a crystal ball for the 21st century, but a message of hope and protest for its original audience.
Exactly. It's meant to inspire endurance and faithfulness in the face of terrifying power, not to help people decode newspaper headlines. That completely reframes the book, doesn't it? It moves from being potentially terrifying to being profoundly encouraging for those facing hardship.
It really does. Okay, that tour through the library gives us a good sense of Johnson's approach. Let's maybe pull out some of the core themes or messages he wants us, the listeners, to really grasp.
Good idea. These are the big takeaways that can shift your perspective.
The first one we've already touched on quite a bit, the diversity within unity. The idea that the NT's strength isn't in being uniform, but in holding different voices, Paul, James, the four Gospels, intention.
Right. And the reflection there, Johnson suggests, is humility, especially in contemporary religious debates. Maybe the goal isn't always to force everyone into one single box, but to appreciate the richness that comes from different perspectives pointing towards a shared center.
Okay, theme number two.
This one is absolutely central for Johnson. The resurrection as the interpretive key.
Meaning?
Meaning the entire New Testament is written from the other side of Easter. The conviction that God raised Jesus from the dead is the big bang that created Christianity. Everything flows from that.
So it's not just remembering a wise teacher.
No, it's proclaiming a living Lord. That conviction is what gives the text their energy, their urgency. They aren't just looking backward. They believe they are encountering the risen Christ in their communities now. That changes how you read everything.
That ties into the next theme, doesn't it? Writing as a response to lived experience. We saw that with Paul.
Exactly. Theology in the New Testament isn't developed in a vacuum. It's practical, it's pastoral. It arises out of community struggles, ethical dilemmas, missionary challenges. It shows how religious ideas stay vital by actually addressing real human needs and situations.
And finally, a theme that runs through pretty much everything.
The ethical implications of religious belief. Johnson stresses that these texts consistently link what people believe about God and Jesus with how they are expected to live.
Faith and works again?
In a broad sense, yes. Theological claims always have ethical demands attached. Believing in this God, following this Christ, necessarily transforms how you treat others, how you structure your community, how you engage with the wider world. It's a whole worldview with practical consequences.
Those are really helpful summaries. Johnson also has some very quotable lines that capture his core ideas.
He does. We've used a couple already, but let's highlight maybe three key ones. First, this really sums up the library idea. The New Testament is best understood not as a single book, but as the literary residue of a dynamic and diverse religious movement.
Literary residue, there it is again. It emphasizes that these are the surviving traces of something messy, alive, and complex, not a perfectly planned, single-authored manual.
Exactly. Then there's one about the Gospels. The Gospels are not biographies in the modern sense. They are faith-filled portraits, each painting Jesus with a distinct theological palette.
Which we discussed. Differences aren't a historical problem, but a source of theological richness. It frees you from trying to harmonize every single detail.
Right. And the third, which we also covered but bears repeating because it's so often misunderstood, to read the book of Revelation as a predictive code for future events is to fundamentally misinterpret its genre.
A crucial corrective. It's about resistance and hope for the oppressed in its time, not a secret code for our time.
Understanding genre is key to responsible reading.
Okay, so taking all this in, how does this knowledge actually apply to your life if you're listening? What are the practical takeaways?
Well, first off, it helps you cultivate informed and critical reading habits. Johnson's approach asking about genre, audience, historical context isn't just for the New Testament. It's a toolkit you can use for reading any complex ancient text, or frankly, even analyzing media today.
Moving beyond just passively receiving information to actively questioning how it's constructed and why.
Exactly. Second application, developing historical empathy. When you read this way, you move past seeing these figures as just stained glass saints or abstract theological mouthpieces.
You see Paul dealing with annoying Corinthians.
Right. You see real people, Paul, the members of the churches in Galatia or Philippi, grappling with factionalism, cultural pressures, persecution, disagreements. Their struggles become more relatable, more human.
And that gives the text a different kind of power, maybe.
I think so. And a third application, particularly for listeners who approach these texts from a faith perspective. This offers a way to bridge faith and reason.
How so?
Johnson's approach allows for a faith that is enriched by honest, critical scholarship, not threatened by it. It helps avoid what he calls a brittle faith, the kind that shatters the first time you encounter a historical complexity or a seeming contradiction that doesn't fit a simplistic literal reading.
So it allows for a more robust, resilient understanding.
That's the idea, an intellectually honest faith.
Okay. As we wrap up our deep dive here, what's one thing that really stood out or maybe surprised you from revisiting Johnson's perspective?
For me, honestly, it's constantly being reminded of the sheer contingency of it all, particularly Paul's letters. The idea that some of the most profound theological statements in Western history were essentially, like we joke, emergency emails written to struggling startup communities.
Yeah.
It just makes the whole thing feel so much more grounded, human, and frankly, more amazing that it endured and had such impact. It wasn't planned in some grand systematic way.
What about you? What's your big takeaway?
I think for me, it's that idea of the evangelists, the gospel writers, as creative theologians, not just scribes taking dictation, but purposeful authors shaping their material, using their distinct theological palettes to communicate something vital to their specific communities. It makes reading the Gospels a much more dynamic experience.
So if we had to synthesize the most valuable lesson from Johnson,
I'd say it's that responsible reading requires integrating a critical mind with an imaginative heart.
Yeah.
You need both.
Yeah.
You need the critical tools to understand the history, the literature, the context.
But you also need the imaginative engagement to appreciate the power, the purpose, the religious vision driving these texts.
Exactly. It's an approach that honors the New Testament as what it is. A historical artifact, yes, but also a literary masterpiece. And for many, a living word of faith.
And maybe a final thought to leave our listeners with, something provocative.
Maybe this. The ultimate insight from Johnson might be that these ancient texts stay alive, they maintain their vitality, not by being frozen in time, demanding only one fixed meaning forever, but precisely because they continue to generate new meanings, new questions, new possibilities for every generation that turns to them seeking insight into community, meaning, justice, and, well, human flourishing. They keep speaking because we keep listening and asking new questions.
A library that keeps offering new discoveries, that's a great place to end.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker. Another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.